Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be taking the Pope to task over his leadership of the Catholic Church, asking whether Canada has got the right answers on drugs policy, and lamenting the death of spontaneity. First, Pope Francis has come under increased scrutiny in recent weeks after his controversial intervention with the Ancient Order of Malta and a decree which has been interpreted by some as a liberalising of the Church's views on remarriage after divorce. After the resignation of Pope Benedict in 2013, a new precedent has been set, and Damien Thompson argues in this week's magazine that the knives are out amongst cardinals who hope to see Francis going the same way. He joins me now, along with Dan Hitchens, the deputy editor of the Catholic Herald. So Damien, every so often on this podcast and in the magazine, we have more rumblings of a plot against the Pope. Can you tell us what the latest push against Pope Francis is?
The reports in the Italian newspapers and some British newspapers that a group of cardinals who voted for him, who aren't traditionalists in other words, have basically had enough. They want to get rid of him. Now, no names are attached to this plot, so we have to treat it with caution. But what I can confirm from talking to senior churchmen is that there's a sort of weariness setting in. Pope Francis has started a huge row about communion for divorced people, which he basically cannot end and he can't resolve. And it's wearing down bishops all over the world.
And is that because they disagree with him?
Some of them disagree with him, some of them agree with him.
And his stance, just remind us of
his stance, I think, could best be described as, you might think that, but I couldn't possibly comment, as in the Pope clearly does want it to be possible for divorced and remarried people to receive communion. He's delighted when maverick bishops or very liberal bishops say, yes, fine, go ahead, and makes it clear that he's delighted, but actually there's no statement from Rome. So this leaves bishops, cardinals, archbishops, ordinary priests, and the couples themselves tremendously confused, and it's wearying because there's no end in sight.
Dan, how much of this is a plot against the Pope, and how much of it is the Pope plotting against himself? He seems, certainly to an outsider, and as far as it's possible for someone whose pronouncements can be infallible to put his foot in things quite a lot.
It is a remarkable situation of division, which I'm not sure the Pope expected. I mean, the Catholic instinct is to love the Pope and respect the Pope, and it's kind of a duty. And even if the Pope is incompetent or flawed or does things people don't like...
Can a Pope be incompetent?
Well, yeah, I mean, there have been many bad decisions taken by Popes, but even then, he'll still generally have the support, broadly speaking, of Catholics. The only red line the Pope can cross, and it's happened a very few times in history, is to look as though he's encouraging beliefs which are at odds with Catholic teaching. And on average, it happens about once every few hundred years. And the Pope hasn't taught anything officially which isn't what Catholics have generally understood about marriage, about communion. But as Damien says, there's an atmosphere which has changed so that those who disagree with church teaching about, say, women priests or communion for the remarried or euthanasia can feel emboldened to say, we've got the Pope on our side, and to say that without contradiction. And those who are more traditionally minded feel more kind of cowed and eventually feel they have to say something, they have to come out in opposition. And that's sort of where these rumblings of a plot are coming from. I mean, I don't think it'll come to anything practically, but there's definitely a high level of opposition.
Damien, do you think it will come to something practically?
Well, let me first say that I don't think people who support women priests feel emboldened directly by this particular Pope, who shows no interest really in women priests, though he is interested in the subject of women deacons, but it's not one of his issues, nor, by the way, is he particularly interested in gay rights. He's reasserted the ban on gay men entering seminaries. But on the subject of communion for the divorced, he basically seems to be pushing priests and bishops to go as far as they possibly can, which is beyond what the existing teaching set in stone says. And that's what's unnerving people. It's a question of tone. The Pope's candour and bluntness seem very refreshing at first, but now day after day after day, he tells the clergy, the bishops, the Roman Curia that they're hypocrites, without ever seeming to adopting a self-critical line. And people are fed up with it. You only have to look at the crowds in St. Peter's Square are much smaller than they were under Benedict, which is something that people in Rome have noticed, but hasn't filtered out to the wider world, because what you do have is a small number of liberal clerics and journalists who are pumping out the propaganda line that this Pope is a great reformer who hasn't put a foot wrong. And they do it relentlessly, and it fits into, if you like, the Guardian or the BBC's notion that any liberal Pope will be opposed by hypocritical, evil old traditionalists.
So you don't think that there's a possibility of a schism, or do you?
There hasn't been one for hundreds of years, and so it's very difficult, not a serious one anyway, so it's very difficult to know what one would look like. What I have picked up is priests and senior clerics telling me that it feels as if there's no Pope at the moment. In other words, they don't trust the man who holds the office, and because he's teaching things which they think go against the teachings of Jesus, and Jesus is very strict about divorce, much stricter about divorce than almost anything else, they feel that, you know, not only do they not like the man, but they feel he's monkeying around with the office and the teachings of the church. So the feeling in the higher levels of the church is extremely uncertain, very unstable. To what extent it's filtering through to parish life is not clear, but I think it's beginning to.
Dan, what's the situation like in the Catholic Church in England and Wales? What's been the response there?
It's been very muted, and that's quite typical. And this is another thing Damien touches on, is the sort of deafening silence that's greeted the Pope's recent document on marriage. I think there's only been one bishop who's brought out a statement explicitly addressing communion for the remarried, and he says the traditional teaching is still in place and nothing has changed. But apart from that, there's a sense of tension, and also a sense that you won't get all the bishops coming together and issuing a statement, or if they do, it will be so anodyne and open to multiple interpretations.
So what can be done to bring the church back together, Damien?
Well, what a lot of people would say is a new pope, which is not, that's not quite as disrespectful or as horrible thing to say as it would have been a few years ago, because in the past, having a new pope meant that the existing one had to die. No longer the case. Pope Emeritus Benedict is about to celebrate his 90th birthday. So there are many, who would like to persuade Pope Bergoglio to step down. He won't. He's an immensely stubborn man. He enjoys being pope. He enjoys the exercise of power in a way that Benedict clearly did not. It made him uncomfortable, and he retreated into his shell, which is why things got very much out of control in terms of corruption during his pontificate. This man is out there. He hasn't taken a day's holiday. He's got visitors every single day. He loves being pope. He loves pushing people around. He loves saying dramatic things. He enjoys the exercise of the office, and I don't think he minds too much if he starts rows that he knows he doesn't have the ability to patch up.
Is there a ringleader in a charge against him, a potential swell of opposition potentially to depose him?
A serious ringleader? If there is, we won't know about it. We know which, you know, traditionalist cardinals hate him most, but I think what's being talked about now is moderate cardinals who want to see a new pope, and they will not be putting their heads above the parapet.
Do they have a candidate?
They're talking about Cardinal Parolin, who's the Secretary of State, but as they say in the Catholic Church, he who enters the conclave, a pope, leads it a cardinal. So in other words, talking up a candidate does them absolutely no good whatsoever, and conclaves tend to produce surprises.
What do you think of Parolin?
I think any speculation about the next pope is difficult, because you can't just install someone, you can't begin a wave of support that continues into the conclave. I mean, he's part of some of the pope's major diplomatic efforts at the moment in China, for instance, maybe a rapprochement with Beijing, which is also proving controversial. But I just think, looking at the College of Cardinals, it's very hard to have any idea who would succeed Francis.
And do you think the situation is really as bad as Damien describes, that there are sections of the Vatican that could be looking to depose Francis?
I mean, there's definitely a lot of discontent in terms of what will happen practically. There are cardinals who might issue a statement of correction and say the way that the Pope has taught has been confusing. It's led Catholics to wonder what the teaching of the Church is. It's brought confusion to particular countries like Malta, where people think church teaching might have changed. But you issue a statement, and then what happens? Maybe nothing.
So Damien, on the next episode of the podcast, where we talk about the latest problems with the Pope, what do you predict we're going to be talking about? What do you predict is going to happen next?
I honestly don't know. I just hope it's not Vincent Nichols walking out onto that balcony. Sorry, shouldn't say that, but there we go.
That was Damien Thompson and Dan Hitchens. And for more of the best arguments about the most controversial topics in world religion, subscribe to Damien's Holy Smoke podcast on the iTunes store. Next, floppy-haired dreamboat Justin Trudeau has often been accused of being more style than substance. But the substance abuse we're talking about this week is cannabis, which is on the way to being legalised in Canada. Danny Kruger was there recently to find out more, and he joins me now, along with Steve Moore, the director of VoltFast, a drugs policy think tank, and Peter Hitchens, a fierce critic of cannabis legalisation. So Danny, tell us who Bill Blair is and why we should be listening to his views on the legalisation of cannabis.
Bill Blair is this huge, great Toronto cop, and his father and grandfather before him were Toronto cops. He's a sort of epitome of, sort of earthy policeman. And he, having retired from the job of chief of police in Toronto, became an MP in Justin Trudeau's government. So he's a Liberal MP. But he comes from quite a conservative background, and his attitude has always been that drugs are a menace that need to be controlled. And he signed up to support Trudeau's legalisation of cannabis on the grounds that it would help keep crime down in Toronto and across Canada and stop the scourge of young people smoking marijuana. So that's been his agenda, and he's helped drive the policy there, and he's led a task force for the government and is now out and about in Canada trying to persuade people of his kind of generation and his kind of social attitudes that they need to rethink their approach to cannabis.
How successful is he being in that mission?
Well, we were really surprised because we spent nearly a week in Canada talking to officials and experts there, and they just have a very different conversation to over here. Remarkably, there's just hardly any opposition to this reform, and people like Bill Blair, who come from a traditional conservative background, and police chiefs like him all recognise that they've got to change their approach. And so it seems to have been very successful.
Steve, do you think there's a difference, when Danny mentions a difference in cultures and conversations between Canada and the UK, do you think this can be translated to the UK debate about drugs, which isn't really a debate, it's more a sort of someone makes a suggestion, everyone gets very cross, and then everything goes quiet again?
Yes, I mean, I think the frames that Trudeau uses are the only frames that could ever work here in the UK. I think his focus on restricting access to teenagers and the focus on breaking criminality are the frames that one could imagine you could frame a socially conservative argument around. But I think the one thing that struck me in Canada was how, as Danny says, the conversation is different because cannabis use is much more normalised and it's much more culturally embedded across the country, particularly on the West Coast in British Columbia.
Peter, do you think that this approach in Canada or in the UK possibly actually helps address the issues that you see around the decriminalisation of cannabis?
Well, both countries have done the same thing. That is, they've pretended to maintain a law, which they're obliged to do by international treaty, and they haven't enforced it. And the official position of government is to lie, that they are enthusiastic about enforcing it while continuing not to do so. And only a few weeks ago it was revealed that the last feeble thing which the police bothered to do with cannabis possession in this country, the cannabis warning, is declining so fast in use. The police will probably stop doing that, even that, fairly soon, so there won't be anything that they do. Part of the startling thing about this piece is that everyone admits the law has not been enforced for years. And so the solution to this is to enforce it even less. And this is in a country which has recently had two soldiers killed in the street, in both cases by people who were long-term cannabis users, which suggests to me that the link between cannabis and mental illness may not be entirely mythical. It's only a correlation, but it would strike me strongly if I were campaigning against this, that this kind of thing is going on in a country which has more or less de facto legalised. Now, Canada is not a member of the UN Security Council, so it can presumably take a more tickle-minded view of its international treaty obligations than we can. But ultimately, you're not allowed to get rid of your laws. All you can do is pretend to enforce them, as they're doing. And the interesting thing is that two countries, two free law-governed countries, Japan and South Korea, have enforced their drug laws and have much, much lower levels of drug use than all these fancy, fashionable decriminalisers do.
Danny, is this just fancy and fashionable?
Well, we certainly don't need to decriminalise it. That's the wrong approach. And Peter's right that the UK government and police forces across Britain are hypocritical in their approach, as most Western countries have been. I just mentioned in passing, South Korea and Japan have entirely different cultures to us. Glorious.
They have entirely different cultures because they have entirely different laws.
Well, it's interesting.
Before we abolished our effective drug laws in 1971, we too had a different culture, as I can personally remember. Culture is decided by law, not the other way around.
There's a relationship, clearly, and the laws massively influenced the culture.
Well, Japan's drug laws were introduced because they had a huge amphetamine problem. It's complete fantasy to try and attribute this to some kind of weird interplanetary cultural difference. Japan enforces its laws, South Korea enforces its laws, we don't.
Yes. So in the UK, there is a hypocrisy around the enforcement of the law, and that is true. And what we don't want is decriminalisation. We don't want turning a blind eye to drug use. We need to recognise what's acceptable and what isn't. I'm not completely convinced yet that we need to legalise cannabis. I was impressed by what I saw in Canada. I think we have a lot of similar conditions. We have a huge amount of cannabis use in this country. Most people who use it have no respect for the law because they see that it's being banned and yet they don't actually recognise that it causes harm. I'd agree with Peter, there is a link between mental health and cannabis. The link is that if you have an underlying mental health condition, you should not be self-medicating with cannabis, which is what enormous numbers of young people with mental health problems do.
How do you know when somebody has an underlying medical condition, pray?
Because it's often only manifested...
Who knows when they've got one of these?
So psychosis is often only triggered by cannabis use.
Well,
you wouldn't have known you had the underlying condition until you took the powerful brain
drug.
On the contrary,
it's the decision to use in a really destructive way large amounts of cannabis that is the evidence of the fact there's an underlying.
Why large
condition.
Amounts? Again, these are assertions airily made.
Well,
children of 12 and 13 are taking cannabis, and I would cite particularly the case of Henry Coben, brilliantly described by his father in that terrible book, Henry's Demons, who took cannabis at a grammar school in Canterbury. At that age, and following that, you can't establish for certain causation, but following that has been through a serious episode of mental illness.
Steve?
I mean, I think the mental health issue is interesting because one of the problems, the difference in Canada is they're much more sanguine about the use of cannabis, and the problem they have is when they conducted focus groups, and the Department of Health conducted focus groups, most people's view in Canada was this is rather benign. And so they have to actually raise the spectre of the issues around mental health. I think the evidence is pretty clear that people who, like Danny, I agree with Danny, the people who have suffered from a range of mental health conditions shouldn't be using cannabis. I think there is...
Too late.
But beyond that, I think our mental health services need to be much more sensitive to the easy access to cannabis that people have. Danny's right. It's clear evidence that people who suffer from the extreme mental health conditions, psychosis and schizophrenia, are likely to self-medicate with cannabis. There's lots of evidence that...
So what do you mean self-medicate?
Medicine
is something which is prescribed by qualified doctors measured doses.
To refer to
illegal drug taking as self-medicating.
But Peter, that's exactly what they're
profoundly,
doing.
It's a profoundly dishonest and misleading, in my view, immoral thing to say.
Well, hang on, that's right.
It's not self-medicating. It's drug-taking. It's the taking of an illegal drug.
Yes. Peter, could you explain the difference for listeners between self-medicating with alcohol, for instance, which is legal, but which is something that doctors often have to warn people with mental health conditions against, and the self-medicating with cannabis that Steve and Danny are talking about?
Well, I don't regard alcohol as a medicine. I think the use of the term self-medication is generally is one which has been inserted in the language by the billionaire big dope lobby, which has had so much success, shockingly, with conservatives in the past 20 or 30 years in inserting listen to yourselves advocating the relaxing of laws against a drug which ruins the lives of the people who take it and of their families. Listen to yourselves. And in 20 years' time, when you've succeeded, listen back to what you've said now and feel ashamed, as you will, of what you did. That's how successful it's been.
And Steve, our mental health services aren't particularly strong in this country anyway, so to actually add a greater burden to them by decriminalising something that could
can we just point out we're actually in agreement, this is a strange conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
Peter, we are
I'm
in
not
agreement.
In agreement with you, absolutely not, sir.
Well, so wait a second. I hope you're in agreement that we don't want children using cannabis.
That's quite right, yes. But you're advocating, provisions which will increase that problem, which is already great.
All right, well, that's the contention then. Let's argue about that.
Demonstrable.
So the challenge for us is how do we restrict access to children? And what they have decided to do in Canada, and what we should think about doing here, I'm not yet convinced, but it's certainly worth exploring, is how do we disrupt this terrible illegal industry that pushes drugs to children? Now, one way that they have decided to do that is to regulate, license, legalise the supply of marijuana to adults, enabling them to break up this criminal business and focus resources and attention and the huge kind of moral opprobrium which should attend to people who sell drugs to children on that market. What we need to do is to absolutely clarify that children should not be using cannabis.
All crime is caused by law. We make laws against things because they're bad. Mm-hmm. The fact that something is regulated doesn't make it harmless. Tobacco in this country, mm-hmm. cigarettes, are regulated mm-hmm. and sold legally by cynical businessmen. And they are not harmless they're regulated. Any more than marijuana would be if it was sold under regulation here and advertised as the Proposition 64 in California is now coming.
Forgive me, I think what is striking is how effective regulation has been in the UK. If you look at the impact on alcohol and on cigarettes over the course of the last 20 years, for example, last year, only 1% of teenagers could get served in a pub in the UK. Today, over half the teenagers in Britain say they have easy or very easy access to cannabis. I've just been to an event this afternoon where kids in London, 96% of kids in London said they get easy access to cannabis.
Yeah. Well, did you ask them? I mean, getting drink in a pub is one thing. All you need to do is go into the parks at places like Birkenhead, and you'll see children of 12 or 13 swigging from litre bottles of vodka, they've obtained illegally.
No, forgive me,
Peter. Because it's extremely easy.
No, forgive me,
Peter. Because vodka is on legal sale and regulated, as you so love to say. It's available.
No, forgive me.
If cannabis is regulated and sold legally, it'll be available to children in the same way.
Teenagers are not roaming the streets of London or this country trying to buy potsheen or buy moonshine.
They could get their friends to buy.
No, they mostly
where do you live.
Okay, let's take it in turns. Steve and then Peter.
So we have built a very effective regime which has reduced alcohol consumption among teenagers and among. Yes, it has. I come from a generation, and so do you, where we could walk into a pub at 16 in a school uniform and get served without question. Over the course of the last 20 years, I think people of our generation, I think, have forgotten how this has our attitude towards alcohol and young people has been transformed in the last 20 years. I don't think people can swing in the park any longer. I think police can confiscate that. So I think we have made a lot of progress in that area. The challenge for Peter is, I mean, the challenge has always been for Peter, is how he's going to implement this new way of criminalising. How many police he's going to hire, at what cost, to our civil liberties. I mean, that's the question I'd love to...
Getting yourself stupefied is not a liberty comparable with the freedoms of speech, thought and assembly. Mm-hmm. Indeed, it might be one that a lot of people might not want to defend. But you really think that alcohol is only on sale in pubs? It's on sale in newsagents. And do you really think the police patrol parks? Where do you live? Where have you been? The world isn't like that. If you legalise cannabis and make it available on ready sale, two things will happen. One, it will be heavily taxed because the Exchequer will very quickly work this out, and there will continue to be a great deal of illegal sale, just as there is illegal sale of cigarettes and alcohol in this country where both are legal. So you won't remove criminals from the system. Secondly, you will have a lot more of it about, and it will be much more readily available to children than it is now.
Okay, moving on. Danny, what are the pitfalls of this approach that's been tried in Canada? When you went there, what were the disadvantages that you saw?
Well, what I didn't like was they have quite open sale of cannabis. At the moment it's illegal, but because they're anticipating a legalisation in the next couple of years, the police are not enforcing the law. So you have these pop-up shops on almost every street in the big cities selling all sorts of cannabis. There are extraordinarily little places where they don't have many signs in the window, but you find out where they are, you walk in, and there is an array of drugs. I think that's a terrible situation. I don't think we want to see drugs being openly sold in the streets. It's not being done with huge amounts of violence and the kind of street crime has disappeared. But nevertheless, you have a situation where drugs are being openly retailed in the streets. I don't think that's advisable. There's a confusion about the difference between medical and recreational use of cannabis. Lots of people pretending to have medical conditions in order just to get high. I think that seems crazy. They'll resolve that by legalising recreational use and properly regulating it, which is not a meaningless concept. It's very important that what we have in the moment is too much toxic drugs being sold, and if you can regulate it, you can make it safer. That's their agenda.
And finally, Peter, if we did have a situation in this country where the current laws were being enforced and we were actually able to see whether or not the approach that we claim to have to drugs actually does work because it was actually being tried out, what would you see being the potential problems with that? Or would everything be solved?
There are problems with everything, but the big plus would be that those many parents who are really scared that their children will ruin their lives with drugs would finally have a powerful argument against the enormous peer pressure which they come under at school and elsewhere, to take these dangerous drugs, whereas at the moment there is none, and it would be a vast improvement. And once you had, as with any law, as with the law against drink driving, and as with now, at last, the law against driving while using a mobile phone, if you enforce a law and make a few examples, people very quickly obey it. It's not a difficult thing to enforce a law if you want to. The fascinating thing about the Western countries over the past 40 years is that they have not enforced a law, and they've therefore left people in terrible danger from a very, very nasty drug.
That was Danny Kruger, Steve Moore and Peter Hitchens. And finally, do you ever find yourself making plans for the summer or even next year and wonder what's happened to the spontaneity of life? Well, that's how Jenny Code found herself feeling, and she sat down with me to despair for our diaries and advocate for a little bit more slumping on the sofa. So Jenny, why are we becoming less spontaneous in the way that we arrange to talk to our friends, to see our friends?
I think it's a funny thing in that we're in contact with people all the time. And so you feel like you're in touch with them. But I don't know whether we're increasingly busy or what it is, but basically no one's free. And so you end up booking things months in advance. And as they get closer, you sort of want to unbook them.
Is that actually, it's not the case that people aren't free. Is it actually the case that people don't want to see other people? Because as you say, you make these plans in advance, and then a year later, when you're actually about to go to the theatre, you think, oh, I don't really want to see these people. And I've only booked it in advance because I didn't want to see you next week.
I think that there is a sort of politeness in saying to people, it's a gesture of friendship when you say, oh, wouldn't it be lovely to have lunch or supper or a drink?
Without meaning it.
Well, the idea is nice, but you know that in reality, it's not what you really want to do. It's actually make it happen, sort of get your diary out. You think, gosh, no, what am I doing? It's a gesture.
I would have thought that social media, that having WhatsApp, iMessage, Facebook message, Twitter DM, email would make it much easier to be spontaneous because you've got so many ways of contacting someone at any one time. Why hasn't it?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I know exactly what you mean, and it does, you think, gosh, you know, we should be able to just text someone and go, let's do this now. And I think people, we do that because you see things when you're out and about and think, wouldn't it be lovely to go to this? And you message your friends and perhaps then arrange it. But I think also it's enabled us to get out of things a lot more easily because you can sort of say, gosh, I'm running late, I'm sorry, or, you know, you can immediately get in touch with someone and apologise and untangle things.
So you can be spontaneously useless.
Exactly.
Are you looking forward to your 2018 trip to the theatre that you write about in the piece?
Very much. That wasn't deliberate. I mean, I said to a friend, let's go and see this, it's had fantastic reviews. And I think it was in the Standard, it says, you know, booking opens this week. And that was the first available evening. I'm not even thinking about it, because to anticipate something that far in advance,
you might forget about it.
That is very likely and a concern, but I'm hoping that my friend who I'm going with is more organised than me.
So you now have to be much better at diary management in this new anti-spontaneous era.
Definitely. I still have a paper diary. I like to write things down because I think you can see it all, and it's easier to actually, if you are trying to block out free time, you can go, look, my week's looking mad. I need to sort of rejuggle things.
And is it just about meeting up with people? I have frequent problems where friends and I actually arrange just to phone one another because spontaneously calling somebody actually seems a bit rude now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when people phone you, somehow it feels like an intrusion. And I know that, well, I mean, I feel like I'm intruding on people if I call them at the weekend. No one picks up their phone anymore. So I think I definitely arrange phone conversations.
You're a travel journalist, so you must have seen lots of different ways of planning ahead or not planning ahead. Is this a uniquely British or European way of doing things?
I think to plan ahead is quite British. I think in the piece I mention a friend who's moved to Chile, and she has this fantastically kind of liberated sort of approach over there. And I think she's found it quite hard because she's used to making plans and everyone there's like, why are you arranging supper with me on Friday? Like, you know, what if we don't want to do it on the day? Like, what if I've gone off the idea? And she's like, well, you'd have to do it because, you know, that you've made a commitment. And when she told me about this over the phone, I was thinking, God, it makes me feel so like rigid and sort of British and uptight about, you know, just do whatever, see what happens on the day, you know, that's their kind of approach. And I think culturally we're a bit more rigid in that respect.
So what are you going to do to try to improve your spontaneity?
I have promised my boyfriend, who absolutely hates it when I give him a sort of schedule for the weekend, that I'm going to leave us.
Does he have any choice over this schedule, or is it allocated?
No, it's a sort of, it's a combination, there's a playoff of things. So if I say to him, look, we're going to have lunch with these friends, who he's always delighted to see, and I'm like, but then, you know, you can go swimming or we can go on a run or something. He's very sporty. And also sit on the sofa, you know, so it's sort of getting the balance. But I promised him that I'm going to try and leave some weekends where I've planned absolutely nothing. And I've got, you know, my expectations are just to do what?
Stay on the sofa, not do
anything. Stay on the sofa, exactly, yeah.
How very spontaneous. That was Jenny Code. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on the podcast, as well as great pieces by Paul Wood, Harry Mount and Joanna Trollope. And we have a trial offer. Get 12 issues for just £12 by visiting spectator.co.uk/12. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.